Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power with Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar. Our guest today is Thomas Woods. He holds a bachelor's degree in history from Harvard and his master's and PhD from Columbia University. He is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He is the author of 11 books, including the New York Times bestsellers Meltdown and The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. Mr. Woods, welcome to the show.
Mark, thank you.
Very glad to have you here today. Rollback, repealing big government before the coming fiscal collapse. Now, everything we're hearing from the news media is that unemployment is way down to 9%. Are we really on the brink of a fiscal collapse?
Well, my argument is that even if we have a robust recovery from the current malaise, and I'm skeptical of that, the problem is we have a budgetary crisis that's coming. So regardless of the health of the economy, the key problem is pretty much twofold. First, let's assume the best-case scenario, you know, robust recovery, interest rates super low. By 2020, we're still going to be paying, even in that best scenario, just about $1 trillion a year in interest payments on the national debt alone. So now we are now hitting a point where it really does matter what the size of the national debt is. I think a lot of people have thought, you know, hey, we've gotten away with it for a long time with being so high. It hasn't seemed to cause any problems. Well, now it's about to. The second thing is the entitlement programs problem, which is that Social Security and Medicare, the federal government is in the hole on those to the tune of, and it's almost impossible to believe this, about $114 trillion. Now, that's pretty well impossible to tax your way out of, $114 trillion. The one consolation, Mark, is that when you hear $114 trillion, it makes the national debt of $14 trillion seem not so bad.
That's true. I guess that's one way of looking at it. Now, of that $114 trillion, how much of that is Social Security and how much of it is Medicaid?
Medicare, the old age.
Medicare, I'm sorry.
Program. It's mostly Medicare, actually. I mean, I would say it's probably maybe 75 to 80% Medicare. So that's, I think that runs a little counter to people's views on this, because they think, because they hear so much talk about the crisis in Social Security, that that's the key thing. I think by the time we have a serious problem with Social Security, Medicare will already have sent serious shockwaves through the system.
Now, is that in part due to the enormous number of people classified as baby boomers who will be hitting retirement soon, or because they'll be using more medical resources soon?
Yes, it is. And indeed, I've got all the numbers in there just showing the inevitability of this, that we, like the rest of the developed world, are facing a serious demographic crisis. And I don't mean to suggest that it's not something to be cheered that people are living longer. That's, of course, a wonderful advance for us. But it is to be deplored that no provision has been made for this. And Japan is already going through this in a very serious way. Japan, though, has a cultural advantage in that people in Japanese society know that you care for your extended family. Whereas in our society, unfortunately, there's this view that once you turn 18, you have the natural right to ignore your parents and your family for the rest of your life. So it'll be a little trickier for us. But this is going on all over the world. And in fact, Western European finance ministers, when cornered behind closed doors, will concede that this demographic crisis that's about to sweep over them is going to just blow away their welfare states. But they themselves will be safely retired by the time that happens.
Now, when you add this to the problem that most states are having in that they really don't have the money for all those wonderful pension deals that they threw in their union contracts, I mean, the country's really in fiscal hot water, is it not? I mean,
oh, yeah, the states, I mean, we're hearing a lot about possible defaults on municipal bonds within the states, and then the states themselves. There are some of them, I think, that would, if they had the opportunity, would like to declare bankruptcy to get out from underneath all the impossible promises they've made. And we're seeing that by 2020, there are 7 states where the pension programs are going to go bust, and by 2025, another 13. And it's going to take 9 years or 14 years in the case of these states, only if they continue to earn 8% a year return. If they don't, which I don't think they will, they're going to go bust even sooner. So it's just, it's a complete disaster all around. And meanwhile, anybody who says, well, you know what, we better reverse course then. Obviously, if we continue on this road, the more we wait, the worse the problem gets. These people are considered enemies of society who hate poor and sick people and want there to be corpses all over the street. I mean, you can't even have a rational conversation.
Which would explain why politicians aren't really motivated to do anything about it. Now, when we saw those riots in Greece, a lot of people said you're looking at America's future. Last few hours, you know, taking a look at Wisconsin, it looks like our future came quicker than we thought.
It's true. I mean, now, Greece is a little different in that, you know, people will protest and burn down buildings just because they're told, you know, you might not be able to retire at age 50 anymore. You might have to wait till you're 51 and a half. And then suddenly this brings the whole house down. But here, you know, there isn't quite as much of a tradition of expecting. I mean, really, the culturally in Greece, I'm sorry to say, just I know this from friends who live there, the expectation is just overwhelming that you should just be able to sit there and be handed things. And we don't have quite as much a tradition of that. But you're right, that I saw a really telling photograph, bird's eye photo of the State House in Wisconsin, where you saw all these people in there just demanding that they continue to, you know, that the state government continue to fork over all this dough that's just impossible for them to fork over at a time when people in the private sector are lucky to have a job at all.
Well, the point I was getting at, I mean, I realize the situation isn't identical to Greece, where apparently, you know, like you said, if you have to work past 30, they get upset. But,
yeah, right.
this is essentially a situation where the fiscal crisis has become such that the governor really doesn't have a choice. And
right.
I had James Dellingpole on a few weeks ago, and he has this great book called 365 Ways to Drive a Liberal Crazy. And he suggested that liberalism is kind of a case of arrested psychological development, because I recall when I was a kid, I thought my parents had these magic pockets and they just kept putting their hand in and pulling out money. So every time we went to a store and I wanted things and they would say, well, you know, we can't afford that, I thought, sure you can. All you have to do is reach in your pocket and pull out some money.
Yeah, well, in fact, when I was a kid, I had a view that if you need money, that's what the bank is for. You drive to the bank and it hands you some money. And actually, it turns out that when you consider government finance, I wasn't that far off as a kid. When you need money, there's some institution that will magically create it for you.
That's great. And again, it seems like a lot of the people who are involved in public unions, public sector unions, think that way. The mere idea that somehow a government could run out of money and not give them everything that they've promised them just doesn't seem real to them. They think somewhere someone's lying to them, somewhere someone's trying to cheat them out of something. Now, let's talk about Obamacare. Now, is that possibly something that's going to save us because of all the cost savings built into that?
That's a softball right over the plate. Well, I'll tell you this. Even the drafters of that law will admit to you that it's not a cost-cutting law. It's a coverage law. And that the cost-cutting, they'll get to that later. Oh, okay, sure, yeah, I'm sure they'll get right on that. So that's the problem, is that it's not cost-cutting. It follows the same principles, really, of the Mitt Romney proposal in, not just proposal, reality, in Massachusetts. You know, everybody gets covered, and insurance companies are severely restricted on how they can vary premiums across different demographics and people's health conditions. They can, I think, charge older people maybe twice as much, but you know they're going to consume 10 times as much. So, in other words, they can't actually price their product according to actuarially sound estimates. And just goes, I mean, it's just on and on, and everybody's required to have it. Nobody can be turned down. The prices can't be varied. And, of course, the problems that are leading to the high cost of medical care these days are not addressed at all. There's no attempt to increase competition across state lines. There's no attempt to deal with the third-party payment problem in which none of us care what our doctors are charging us because some chump is picking up the tab, so nobody goes around doing any cost comparisons, whereas in areas that are not covered traditionally by insurance, like LASIK surgery or plastic surgery, we have indeed seen costs come down because people shop around like they do with any other product. So none of this is actually addressed. Everything that might exacerbate the current situation is intensified. So, no, there is no cost-cutting that is going to take place. If anything, the costs have been dramatically understated, as I indicate in the book. And so if anything, this is contributing further to the problem. And this should not, I mean, does this come as a surprise to people that they've passed something that, that is going to cost a lot more than they told us and is going to make our situation worse? How could we be surprised at this by
now? Well, you saw just in the last 48 hours the big Medicaid fraud bust, and one of the things Obama told us is he was going to pay for this thing in part by reining in the fraud. Is he on his way to delivering that promise?
I don't know. Who knows what the degree of fraud is, but I, at the same time, isn't this the usual thing that if we just crack down on fraud, we'll be able to save a whole lot of money? If that happens, and somehow he's able to pay for this whole thing by cracking down on fraud, it will be the first time in the history of the U.S. that talk about getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse hasn't just been a throwaway line to satisfy the rubes.
Now, one of the things you pointed to in your book was the need for more physician assistance, or is that that's being one possible solution that these people could treat the colds and sore throats and whatnot? But we already have a lot of physician assistants in this country. We already have a lot of nurse practitioners. You mentioned the possibility for pharmacists. There are even consulting pharmacists with prescribing authority who are frequently employed in nursing homes. Haven't we already tried all those things and they really haven't made a dent in it?
Well, I've got a laundry list of things. There are all sorts of ways that we could handle this sort of problem. As I say, the tax treatment, special tax treatment that health benefits get has skewed things in the direction of, because, for example, if your employer provides your medical care, you get to save tax-wise as opposed to if they just handed you a lump sum of money. Well, I'm proposing let them hand you the lump sum of money tax-free so that then you get to go spend it, and again, you're going to be more careful when it's your own money. I mean, if we dealt with potato chips the way we do with medical care, potato chips would be $1 million a bag. Like every single trend that exists is against it. And I give examples of this throughout, but the bottom line here really is that what I'm trying to do in the book is sort of like peel away layers of an onion. You know, and the first layer is, okay, we can't possibly, you know, keep all these promises the federal government has made. It's going to have to renege on some of them. That's the first layer. And the second layer is, now let's look at what Obama's contribution to the situation we're in is. And then the third layer and fourth layer and fifth layer are, okay, now let's look at the things we're told about the financial crisis, and isn't government our great friend that gets us through these things, and wherever would we be without them? And then the next layer is, but without the Federal Reserve, wouldn't we all be crawling around in the dirt eating worms, and the economy would collapse? And then the next, and it just goes on. And by the time you get to the final layer, we're getting down to some of the most basic services of government that we've been told, you know, we'd all be dead without. What if the government wasn't providing scientific laboratories? We'd all be idiots doing rain dances and voodoo. I mean, what I'm doing is just going step by step with the low-hanging fruit like Obamacare first, and then saying, well, you know what, given that we're in this impossible fiscal condition and dramatic cuts are going to have to be made, we might as well go back and see if maybe we could live without these things after all. Maybe we've been sold a bill of goods. Maybe this is not a case where the government is just wonderful, selfless public servants pursuing the common good, and we're just all a bunch of stupid rubes who'd be pathetic morons without them. Maybe that's not, in fact, the case.
Let me ask you a couple other things about Obamacare that I found strange. In addition to, you know, everything in there that's bad, like, you know, getting rid of the pre-existing clause, which basically means, you know, insurance companies can, you know, I mean, be hit on at the last second when somebody finds out they've got cancer. You know, hey, I've been paying the penalty up till now, but hey, I just got diagnosed with cancer. Guess what? I want insurance.
Exactly right. Yeah, what would be, especially since the fines are that you'd have to pay are much lower than the amount you'd have to pay for the insurance. So what is to stop people from waiting till they get sick, then applying for insurance? They can't be turned down for a pre-existing condition. Obviously an insurance company can't possibly make that work. I mean, a private company can't be run like a welfare agency. So inevitably this means the collapse of the insurance companies, which they have to know that. Like, this can't just be an accident. They have to know that, and that will then lead to calls for nationalizing the insurance companies. I mean, you can predict every step of this. It's another one of these slow-motion train wrecks, but unfortunately, you know, if it was a real slow motion train wreck, you might be able to do something about it. But this is like you're having a dream. You know, and every time, you know, you have a dream and there's something going on in slow motion, for some reason, like, you're always standing in molasses or something, or you're in a swamp, and you can see it going on, but there is nothing you can do, and that's, I think, how the people feel right now.
I think so. It's like a bad case of deja vu. You know, you see, if you've ever experienced that, you feel it happening and you can't stop it, or for anyone who's ever participated in sports, and the opening gun fires and suddenly it feels like everything is going in slow motion.
Yeah.
Now, there are some bizarre things in this bill in addition to how it deals with health care. I mean, it essentially, if I'm not mistaken, federalizes the student loan program. And there's this really bizarre, and I want to get into the gold standard thing with you in a little bit, but there's this bizarre thing in there about precious metal purchases over $600 have to be tracked. What do you think
about? Well, then there was also a thing in there saying that people have to fill out tax forms for any purchases they make of any kind over $600 with any merchant at all. And then they repealed that recently, because that would have added paperwork headaches for particularly small businesses that would have just been unthinkable. They repealed that. So I don't know if that also applied to the precious metal purchases, but whether it did or it didn't.
Actually,
major
coin collecting magazines and companies that sell bullion say it's still in there.
Okay. Well, because either way, the interesting thing would be what was their motivation in inserting it there? And, I mean, I don't think one has to be especially cynical, even though I happen to be, to think that, well, they realize that, you know, the you-know-what is about to hit the fan, and a lot of people are going to try to flee out of the dollar to protect themselves, and they want to know who these people are, and they want to be able to have some kind of inventory of who's got what. And that's not the kind of information that they're entitled to.
Isn't it interesting that liberals who felt Big Brother was breathing down our necks whenever George Bush's administration wanted to listen in on the phone calls of terrorists aren't jumping up and down and screaming that gold and silver purchases in the amount of $600, and let's be honest, that doesn't even buy a half ounce of gold anymore, are going to be tracked? It doesn't get any more 1984 than that.
No, it doesn't, and it just goes to show how few people are really consistent in their principles, and how few people aren't just partisan hacks, you know, who make hay for political purposes, but as they prove again and again, really when it comes down to it, they couldn't care less about the principle involved.
One of the things you note in the book, and I find very interesting, is that if you happen to be a member of one of the unions that collectively gave about $5 million to Obama's campaign, you get to opt out of this.
Well, I mean, as I said, you know, that is the classic example of why it is so dangerous for us to buy into the schoolhouse rock version of government. Now don't get me wrong. Now, I don't know how old you are. We're not going to talk ages.
I'm 47. You gave your age away with that one.
Okay, but you know, we watch that, and, you know, I liked Schoolhouse Rock, but it's like, you know, how does a bill become a law? Well, you know, our wise public servants perceive a problem in society, and so they leap to the aid of the people, and they introduce a bill, and this is still taught in schools, whatever. And meanwhile, the reality of the situation in which, you know, it's lobbyists angling for special privileges that are extracted from the rest of hardworking society, and, you know, closed-door negotiations go on, and smoke-filled rooms, and this and that. None of that gets mentioned, even though that's exactly what goes on all the time. And so if there's one thing that we can do that would be important to turning things around, it would be to banish forever this sixth-grade version of government in which these are just innocent and wise overlords, and my goodness, we better wave incense in front of them, because where would we be without their important contribution? No, we need to see it for what it is. I mean, it is a looting operation that is just churning and going on 24 hours a day and destroying the American prospects in the process.
Well, you've given me an idea. I think we need to remake the I'm Just a Bill, which, by the way, is my favorite of all the Schoolhouse Rock. I mean, the Conjunction Junction one comes close, but I'm Just a Bill, I think, is the one people our age can sing most of the words to.
Yeah.
I think we need to remake that and bring in the lobbyists and the, you know, the backroom deals and the under-the-table payments and give the kids a real dose of what's going on.
Now, also, they need to redraw when they do the cartoon. They have to draw the bill so that it's actually this obese, 2,000-page thing, like you can barely stand up, and nobody bothers to read it, and even if you tried to read it, nobody would know what it meant.
Yeah, and then like 1 hour before the vote, they add 600 pages to it.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I'm telling you, you and I should look into this. This has got to be done.
I think so. You know, one of the things I want to give the Democrats credit for is that they are excellent at utilizing the social media and coming up with stunts like Obama Girl and all that, and I hate to say this, but in this world we live in, that may penetrate the mind of most Americans more so than getting something on Meet the Press.
No, I'm afraid so. And I mean, you know, on the other hand, there have been some ways in which, you know, the good guys have made use of this. Like, you know, that people, I think, are sometimes get annoyed by those animated videos on that website, Extra Normal. I don't know if you've seen that, but you know, where you can go and write your own little script and put it in the mouths of these animated characters, and there you go. You got your own little internet movie. And somebody made a movie about Ben Bernanke and quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve, which all sounds very technical and complicated, but which a lot of people thought, I'm not sure I'm buying this bit of hocus pocus. And so a guy made a video about it, and here's a totally abstruse, difficult topic for a lot of people, and the thing gets almost 2 million views. Because it's a little cartoon. So maybe we
right.
have to sharpen our animation skills and just focus there.
Well, I mean, there's so many examples of those lines being blurred between the entertainment world and the news media. A good example of that, and I hate to keep bringing up prior guests, but I had John Ziegler on who did that film about Sarah Palin, and he said he was interviewing Barbara Walters on his radio show at one point, and she actually thought Sarah Palin had said, I can see Russia from my house. Now, that wasn't the news. That was Saturday Night Live. Tina Fey. And this is Barbara Walters, somebody who should know better. And she's getting her news from Saturday Night Live and probably places like Comedy Central. So, yes, it's like any topic you want to pick, you start trying to get into it. And I want to get into the Graham Leach Bliley act in just a minute, but you can, you know, try to have a conversation about that. And I realize you pointed out that, and this was a surprise to me because of how it's been portrayed in the media, that the ability of commercial banks to buy up mortgage-backed securities existed before that. I mean, that's kind of a common miscommunication out there, but it certainly did contain some changes to the Community Reinvestment Act that allowed Acorn to go on a nationwide arm-twisting spree with the bankers. And when you try to talk about that act or Acorn, or you know, you get the deer in the headlights look back from most people. So I think if we made any mistake at all, it's by not dumbing this down to the point where, you know, at least some of the people in the middle will get it.
Yeah, I mean, what I try to do in my own work, I try to do both. I mean, like in Rollback, what I'm trying to do is give people all the ammunition they need so they can win any argument, basically. So that the next time somebody says to you, deregulation caused the financial crisis, you can smack them down so hard they'll never bother you again. And it's not like this is all about winning arguments or making people feel dumb. Like I'm not interested in doing that. I want people to understand how the world works, and if that means in the process you win some arguments, all to the good. But at the same time, in my public speaking, which I'm sort of known almost as much for that as for my writing. But when I do that, it's much more on the level of, you know, using humor and simplifying things and taking a populist line, which is that basically and it's a line that I believe in, which is that I'm sick and tired of being told that I am just a stupid prole who's not entitled to an opinion on technical, sophisticated things like monetary policy. I should shut my mouth and let the geniuses run things. When the geniuses have been wrong pretty much so consistently, like Ben Bernanke has been wrong so consistently that in a way it's almost as good as being right consistently, because this way I just know that whatever he says, the opposite is true, and I got a pretty good overview of the economy. That's great. If you're wrong all the time, it's almost as good. You could. It's like George Costanza. You could just do the opposite. You know, your every instinct is wrong, so just do the opposite. And then, when you make that kind of appeal to an audience, you know, they might not understand the ins and outs of the repeal of Glass-Steagall or whatever, but they hear that and that resonates with them. Yeah, you know, who are these eggheads, after all, to be lecturing me and telling me that I shouldn't be critical of the Fed because I don't know enough and whatever? Really, have they proven that they know enough to be entitled to an opinion?
I wasn't going to bring up a TV show, but since you brought up George Costanza, when you said that, I was reminded of a line from MASH with Hawkeye talking to Frank Burns, and he said, "You're always wrong, Frank. That's what's so right about you."
There you go.
So since you're my age, I thought you might catch that reference, and maybe we can apply that to Bernanke. One of the promises that Barack Obama made as he was running for office is that we would not see any additional taxes on people or families making under $250,000 per year. Originally, when we saw the penalty in the health care bill for not buying insurance, we were told, it's not a tax. It's not a tax. Who could forget Anthony Weiner on television saying, it's not a criminal offense? And Raleigh was saying, but the IRS is going to collect it. You know, this is a tax. It's not a criminal offense. So we were told no taxes under $250,000 a year. When the states begin challenging Obamacare, what's the first thing they say about that penalty? Well, that falls within our ability to tax. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's they've been doing this for years and years and years. They did it with Social Security. They couldn't decide whether that was a tax or whether that was an insurance program. So for a while, they called it a tax because they weren't sure that they would have constitutional ability to impose an insurance program. And then it became an insurance premium. And it became whatever it had to be. It didn't matter what the nature of the thing was. It was whatever they said it was. That's what we have to live with. Reality is what these people tell us it is. Well, I'm not going to live in a world like that.
Well, you know, another thing that the bill contains is the Cadillac tax on insurance. It's amazing. If you don't have insurance, you're in trouble. And if you've got it and it's too good, unless, of course,
you're also in trouble. And meanwhile,
you're also in trouble.
The one thing that they're not offering through these various state exchanges they want to set up, the one thing they're not offering is the very thing that would help to keep costs down, which would be the bare bones, minimum, high deductible, emergency only type policy, which is really all a 22-year-old is probably going to need anyway. And it's that sort of thing. It's because of the high deductible, you know, a few thousand dollars, let's say, that, again, makes you shop around, makes you say, well, do I need to go to the doctor because I have a runny nose? I mean, maybe this is not the best use of everybody's resources. It makes you think. It makes you realize there are trade-offs with health as with everything else in this world. But that is the one thing that's excluded. They refuse to offer a plan like that. When that's really, and there is research that shows that this is indeed a way to make people more responsive to price, which is the most important thing right now.
What do you see the future of this law being? Do you think that Republicans will eventually be successful in repealing it? Will the House be successful in defunding it? Or do you think, you know, once you've given the people something, even if it doesn't start until 2014, that it's almost impossible to take away?
Well, if they do manage to repeal it, which I don't have much confidence in, they'll replace it with something that's, you know, 60% as bad. I mean, that's pretty much been the Republican record over the years. So I'm not super confident. In terms of the Supreme Court, I know a lot of people are heartened when they see some of these lower court judges speaking out against Obamacare. And they think, well, when we appeal this to the Supreme Court, the momentum will just be overwhelming, and they may well have to declare it unconstitutional. I'm not so sanguine about that, and the reason is we've got four liberals on the court. We've got Kagan, Sotomayor, Breyer, and Ginsburg, and we've got four more or less reliable conservatives in Thomas, Scalia, Roberts, and Alito. So the wild card, then, is Anthony Kennedy. And the problem here is that Anthony Kennedy has made his career around the idea that he just does not want to be disliked and spoken badly of in law school faculty lounges. So now that is not the type of heroic character we're going to need. I mean, is this the personality type that will stand up on a matter of grave importance of historic significance and say no to fashionable opinion, I'm afraid, you know, that this is a pretty thin reed we're resting our confidence on.
Speaking of being afraid of how you're spoken about in lounges and throughout, you know, various regions, I think what you pointed out about, you know, everyone saying at the minute you talk about not delivering on all of these entitlements, that you're portrayed as being this horrible person who doesn't care about the poor, doesn't care about the old people. You know, you want to unplug grandpa's kidney machine. But when you look at this particular bill, it seems to me that obviously healthcare rationing would have to come into play when you dump 30 million additional people or more into the system. In terms of our quality of care, in terms of how grandma and grandpa are really going to be treated, what's the reality of this bill?
I think it's completely disingenuous of supporters to claim that we're just dreaming up the possibility that there would be some type of rationing. How could there not be? How could there not be? The potential demand for health services is, of course, unlimited. There's no logical stopping point. You can always consume more health services, but there are only so many such services to go around, and, of course, there will be fewer physicians under this plan. There can be no doubt about that. We've already heard astonishing numbers of physicians who are retiring early because they don't want to be around to see. They're already brokenhearted at what's happened to their profession with the existing government involvement. They don't want to watch this happen. So we're going to have fewer and fewer people going into medicine, more and more people making demands of the system, and everything seems sort of free to a lot of the population. How does that work out? I mean, other than just positing, you know, some kind of sugar candy mountain as an Animal Farm, this is not going to be all sunshine and lollipops. At some point, it has to be decided, and you could easily imagine when we have this crisis that I'm telling you is going to happen, and it's not because you have to rely on my word for it. I give you all the numbers. When this crisis comes, you could easily imagine pressure being put on older Americans, with the implication being that it's kind of your patriotic duty to shut up and die already. And you know, we think that can't happen here. You've got to be kidding me. Under conditions like that, and with, I think our population is not exactly in the greatest moral condition it's ever been in, I think anything is possible.
So was Sarah Palin that far off whenever she suggested that the end-of-life counseling language in the bill might, in fact, amount to death panels?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big Sarah Palin fan, I think that's one of the best things she ever said. And you can tell it's one of the best things she ever said precisely because of the hysteria that it provoked with all the people immediately rushing to contradict her. Well, then you know you have touched a nerve. When they act like that and they get in overdrive with the smear patrol, you know you are getting close to the center of things.
If you take a look at what some liberal Democrats said as leading up to this bill, I mean, you know, you can go back to, was it Tom Daschle who said old people in America need to learn to grow old and die gracefully? And then you had Rahm Emanuel's brother Ezekiel showing his little graph, which essentially suggested that life before the age of, was it 3 or 5, and after the age of, you know, 65 is worthless. And you see liberal doctors on television saying Americans consume 90% of their total medical cost in the last few years of their life, and, you know, this simply isn't a way to allocate resources. It seems to me that they actually do want to pull the plug on grandma so that younger people who don't have insurance, you know, either because they don't have a job or they don't have a job where the employer is able to provide the insurance, can have that coverage. I mean, it seems to me that if you listen closely to their words, that's exactly what they want to do, is stop wasting all that money in the latter years of one's life and look at, you know, things like quality-adjusted life years to reallocate those resources to younger people.
Right. Now, obviously, if you're talking about your own personal fortune, well, it's up to individuals. How do they want to allocate those resources? I mean, it could well be that somebody of advanced age could say, I'm not so sure that devoting X dollars to some experimental treatment is really the best path for me. I mean, maybe I should indeed just, you know, let nature take its course naturally and hand this on to my heir. I mean, that's a family decision. That's up to them. But when government is involved, then naturally it becomes our resources, which of course means the government's resources. Let's speak honestly here. And I just, when I hear things like this, I find it so creepy and Orwellian, because here's Tom Daschle or whoever it was telling us, lecturing us about how we need to die gracefully. In other words, don't put more pressure on the system, just get the heck out, you know, and go meet your final reward. But yet, don't you have the funny feeling that on Tom Daschle's deathbed, he's going to be demanding every last service he can possibly imagine to prolong his life for another 15 seconds? Does anybody doubt that at all? So that he feels that he being one of our overlords, of course, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. He's entitled to a different level of care than the rest of us. Does anyone doubt that for 1 second?
I know I don't. Then again, I'm used to seeing politicians pass laws that don't apply to them, and if I'm not mistaken, Obamacare was one of those.
Yeah, that is indeed true. You know, they're our public servants. We can't trouble them with such details.
I tell you, it's my understanding that, and this is a bit off the subject of the book, but it's my understanding that if you've served 2 terms in the House or 1 term in the Senate, you get your salary for life. If they want to send us a symbolic gesture that they're serious about doing something with the budget, eliminating that would be a good place to start.
Oh, sure. It would be great to see them take away some of their own perks. So let's hold our breath. In fact, let's, for the rest of the program, let's just sit silently and waiting for that to happen.
You can do that. I'm not going to.
Yeah,
As much as I used to love seeing how long I could hold my breath when I was in lifeguard training as a teen, no. Well, you know, you've pointed out in your book that deregulation, and you do an excellent job of supporting this, did not cause the economic meltdown. Talk to my audience about what did.
Okay, so what? First on this, this is not a cop-out, but just so people know, the book Rollback has got all the stuff in it. So here I'm just giving the basic overview, but there is everything you'd want to know just in order, again, to win an argument with your neighbor who thinks you're an idiot, you could find in there. But for here, I would say that clearly when we look at the history of financial deregulation, there isn't anything that's actually relevant to what happened. They did deregulate some things, but none of the things they deregulated have anything to do with the crisis. The crisis occurred because banks made bad loans. Well, that's what banks traditionally do. They make loans. So the problem was that banks engaged in bad traditional banking practices. It wasn't that banks were doing crazy new things that deregulation had made possible for them. They just made bad loans. What I'm arguing here, now, I had a book 2 years ago, one of my biggest selling books, Meltdown, was a New York Times bestseller, precisely on this subject of what the heck did cause it. And I reprised that argument a bit in Rollback so people don't have to buy both books. I'm actually telling you that as a secret. I would like people to buy both books, but they, strictly speaking, don't have to. But what I was arguing in there is that when we look at the whole story, not just the little tiny snippet that we get on 60 Minutes, but the whole story, we see the government's fingerprints and the central bank's fingerprints all over it. Now, that's not to say that there weren't Wall Street actors who were guilty of all manner of outrages. I'm not disputing that. But I'm arguing, as Peter Schiff does, that it's not enough to say Wall Street got drunk, as George Bush did. The question becomes, well, who gave them the alcohol? And my answer is, it's the Federal Reserve. Because what's supposed to happen in a normal free market economy is that if you have a crazy mania like we had with housing, and man, Mark, I mean, of course, we all know we had a crazy mania. I mean, we had people, you know, who had no job, holding 4 investment properties that they were financing with interest-only mortgages, and people really thought that all you need to do to get rich is you buy some real estate and you just sit there. I mean, like, that's how you get rich. You just buy some real estate, it automatically goes up in price, and all you have to do is sit. Now, and once you get to that point, it's like Joe Kennedy said at the time of the Great Depression, when the local stock boy in the supermarket is giving me investment advice, that's when I know that the bubble is about to burst. When everybody's got his hand in it, then I know it's gone too far. So we had this crazy mania. What interest rates are supposed to do is tell us to stop. Interest rates are supposed to be, as Hayek said, a break. They're supposed to be the red light. They're supposed to be the thing that says, you've done too much of this. The economy can't support all this expansion of this sector, so stop doing it. But interest rates were not allowed to rise to reflect this. Every time interest rates were about to rise, the Federal Reserve smacked them down again. So instead of the economy getting red lights or yellow lights, every light was green. full steam ahead. Everybody continue. It was the Fed that juiced up the system that made it possible to perpetuate the housing boom in the first place. Now, the Federal Reserve is not a private free market institution. It was established by an act of Congress, and it enjoys monopoly privileges that are granted to it by Congress. That's not a free market institution. But because the Fed has been able to operate in the shadows and no one talks about it, no one criticizes them, in fact, to the contrary, we're expected to get out and kneel down and wave incense in front of the great chairman of the Federal Reserve, it's been easy to blame all the problems it causes on the free market because it doesn't exist or it's just wise and there's no way to criticize. No. That's got to stop. The market economy has done miracles for mankind. It's been the greatest benefactor in human history, and it's about time it stopped being blamed for stoking the flames of financial crises that were brought about by government and its moral hazard and its central bank.
Okay, softball number two. But, Mr. Woods, hasn't the Federal Reserve been able to lessen the number of recessions and the severity of the recessions that do occur?
That is the normal argument, is that, well, sure, the Fed may have caused this problem. The Fed may have caused the Great Depression, and it may have caused the situation we're in now, but, you know, this is just practice. But for the most part, the Fed has smoothed out business cycles and given us fewer recessions, and they've been shorter and so on and on. That's actually not true, it turns out. The only reason people have been led to believe that that is true is that for a long time we've been erroneously relying on phony baloney statistics that now economists are chucking out the window. The statistics are all wrong, it turns out, and this is not something that I made up as a way of justifying my position. Christina Romer was one of the chief Obama economists, and she has written two major academic reports on precisely this, saying that these numbers are all wrong. They exaggerate the extent of recessions before the Fed, and they minimize the extent of them afterward. That, to the contrary, we have not seen a downturn in the number of recessions, and in fact, the recessions have on average been longer in the age of the Fed. So the Fed's alleged great record of smoothing out instability is completely erroneous and misleading. And in fact, one of the reasons that output and all these economic figures are, you know, they look so unstable in the 19th century, part of it is we still didn't have a really great monetary system in the 19th century. It was better than now. But part of the reason is, remember, it's an agricultural economy, and you tend to have very substantial swings from one year to the next because of things like harvest failures, where your output goes way, way down one year and then shoots up another year and then goes way down. So it looks like a crazy, cyclical, volatile system. But in fact, most of the volatility is due to the fact that you have harvest failures. In the 20th century, on the other hand, the volatility that we see in the economy is much more directly attributable to the monetary policy. So again, this is the sort of thing, if you talk about the Federal Reserve, you will run into people who will often not know very much about the subject, but they will throw at you, but it's given us more stability, or wherever would we be without it? And if you've got even one paragraph's worth of knowledge on this subject, this is usually enough to send people running the other way. They say, hey, look over there, and they run away.
One of the things you talk about in the book is that if we were on a hard money system, you know, the types of games that are played by the Fed with the money supply couldn't happen. Talk to the audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, now we still were on a kind of gold standard when the Fed was established, but not fully. The Fed could still print up money that was not backed by any gold at all. But still, there was nevertheless some kind of check in the system. People portray the idea of gold or hard money as being some kind of elitist thing. No, gold is the people's money. The money that we have now is completely controlled by one central institution, and they can create as much as they want, they can destroy as much as they want, they can hand it out to people and not tell us who got it. You can't do that with gold. Do we have a gold production machine that can just be created out of thin air? In fact, this is one of the reasons that we have all this risk, systemic risk in the system, and all this leverage, and the investment banks are doing risky things, is precisely that they know that we have an institution that can just create money out of thin air and bail them out. So they behave recklessly. And I give evidence of precisely this. They behave this way because of the incentives that exist in the system. But if you had a system where the money was precious metals, then people would realize, well, wait a minute, there is no way to just print up gold and hand it to me to bail me out, so I better be more careful. I better be more conservative and sober. I mean, if you look at, you know, people who lived in our grandparents' generation, you look at the entrepreneurs there, you know, obviously there are always wild speculators. But, you know, wild speculators, a normal system has a way of reining them in. You make a few speculative errors and you're wiped out and that's the end of it. Nobody comes to your rescue. But what you really find is just how serious and sober they were, and they made sensible decisions. They had a whole different culture of entrepreneurship and business at that time, whereas now it's a whole different world under the incentives we live with now.
But if we were on a hard money system, instead of having inflation, we would tend to, as you point out in your book, see deflation. Now, everything you hear about deflation, when you hear anything about it at all, is typically bad.
Yeah,
you've got to pay back those dollars with dollars that are worth more.
Right. So what I'm trying to do also here is to explain to people that, in fact, the concern about deflation is totally overblown, that we should be much more concerned about inflation for a whole bunch of reasons that I outlined there. But when we have deflation, what does that actually mean? Well, most people define deflation, I mean, you could define it as the money supply going down, but most people define it as prices falling. And we're sort of told that, you know, you can't have, how can you make business profits if your prices keep falling, the prices for your goods? Well, I explain in the book exactly how you can have business profits if the prices for your goods are falling. But we can skip all that analysis by just saying, well, all through the 19th century, except during wartime, prices in the U.S. did fall, and obviously businesses did not go bankrupt all through the 19th century. They all survived. They went down very sharply in some periods of time during the 19th century. And what that meant is that if you had money saved, that money could command a whole lot more resources than it could now. In fact, the dollar held its value consistently from about 1790 to about 1913. It was worth about pretty much the same. It was, you know, $100 was $100. Whereas now, if you have $100, that would have been like $4 in 1913. Now, you know, am I supposed to be worried about a system in which the dollar held its value consistently? Or am I supposed to be worried about a system in which 96% of its value is whittled away? I mean, I think I know the answer.
But, Mr. Woods, when prices fall and you have deflation, those senior citizens on fixed incomes can actually buy more. I mean, that's not a good thing, is it?
Yeah, see, here's the thing. Now you notice here that the people who are the losers during inflation become the winners during deflation. And so the people who lose during inflation are all the anonymous Americans who aren't connected to the money creation machine. When the Fed creates money out of thin air, you know, the recipients are, you know, investment banks or government contractors or people who are right up at the top of the food chain, and they get the money first. They get the money before prices have yet risen, so they get to enjoy a windfall, whereas the average Joe gets it much later when prices have risen, and so he loses. But when you reverse the process, all the people who lose win, and the people who had won lose. And you notice that the people who win are all the influential people with good connections to government. So naturally, they and the media who do their bidding are going to cry bloody murder when deflation occurs. And you realize why that is, because it's in their interest to have inflation. It's in their interest to be getting a lot of new money right from the spigot and enjoy artificial advantages and get cheap money at low interest rates and be able to borrow and be heavily leveraged, which means you're buying assets with borrowed money. But with deflation, this hurts people who are engaged in this type of rickety, crazy business practice, so they don't want that. They don't care that older people get to buy more stuff. They couldn't care less. They themselves are threatened. And so this is really why we hear all the hysteria about deflation, because it hurts the most powerful, the people who have taken most advantage of the system. So, of course, we hear their interests represented on the business networks, but we don't hear the interests of the average person who would love to see the value of his dollar increase. And as I say, the value of the dollar increased, excepting wartime, during the 19th century, and, you know, the earth did not break free of its axis and go tumbling toward the sun. People rather liked that situation.
Well, what about the argument that if you live in a world where you have falling prices, that nobody would ever buy anything because they would keep waiting for the price to drop a little bit more? Kind of like that thing your science teacher tells you in eighth grade, that nothing ever really touches anything. If you drop something out of the window, it never really hits the ground, because before it gets to the ground, it has to get halfway there, and then it has to get
right.
halfway between that. So what about
yeah, right,
that argument?
Nothing ever reaches the ground, and yet,
right.
and yet in fact,
nobody ever buys anything.
Right, yeah. And in fact, just as in your analogy, things in fact do reach the ground, so you know that that analysis must be wrong. People do buy things when prices are falling, and the classic example is computer prices have fallen unbelievably. I mean, when you consider the little miracles that we have called laptop computers, that are just we couldn't have dreamed of a thing like this years ago, and this thing, the price of this thing goes down all the time. Does that mean nobody buys a laptop because we're all waiting, because we know that in 2020 it'll be even cheaper, so I better just sit back and wait for that? Well, the thing is that, yeah, okay, sometimes if you think the price is going to go down, you might wait. If 5 minutes from now it's going to get cheaper, or even a month or 2 months from now, I might hold off. But there's another offsetting factor, which is I prefer things now to things in the future. I'd rather have an Apple now than 100 years from now. That's the other factor at work. I would rather have this good. It's more serviceable to me if I have it sooner rather than later. And so it turns out that people do not, in fact, wait until they're on their deathbeds to buy an iPod or a Mac or something like that. They need the services that it gives them now. So they do buy things. And as I say, the computer industry is absolutely flourishing, even though prices keep falling and falling and falling. People buy more and more and more. They can afford to buy it, too. That's another thing. If the price hadn't fallen, if the price just stayed high or went higher, well, people could afford to buy fewer. You might wait even longer. You might have to save up more and more money. This way, because the prices are going lower, you don't have to wait as long to buy it. So, I mean, the offsetting factors more than compensate for that effect.
For people our age, that's about the only deflation I guess we've seen is in the
yeah.
technology
yeah.
sector. Everything
yeah.
else, always has gone up. Now, in the 5 or 6 minutes we've got left, I'm going to ask you to take us to the promised land. There's an old saying, if you bring up problems and you don't have a solution, you're just griping. I know you said in your book that the train has pretty much left the station as far as getting out of this in some painless way. There's going to be a lot of sacrifice that has to be made, but take my listeners through it. What's it going to take for America to eventually get out of this?
Okay, well, Chapter 7 has got some pretty outside-the-box thinking in it. I mean, if the book hasn't blown your mind by chapter seven will do it. I'm just going to say something about maybe some of the more conventional approaches, and one of them would be this. Again, I don't want it to sound like this is all just a policy wonk book. I would rather jump out a window than write a policy wonk book or just a bunch of numbers. But one sort of practical policy thing I'm recommending, which would have been considered completely out of bounds 5 or 10 years ago, like it wouldn't have even been listened to, is this: that let's say you turn 65, you ought to be able to be given this choice, that you can either receive the benefits to which you are entitled by the terms of these programs, or you can forswear those benefits and in exchange for that, for the rest of your life, receive complete exemption from income, estate, and gift taxes. Well, I mean, I personally would grab that in a second. I have no intention of retiring. For one thing, I stink at golf. And I love what I'm doing. I want to just keep on working. So I would gladly take that. That would immediately take substantial pressure off the system. You have far fewer people drawing from it. Now, that would be considered unthinkable, because the idea of making the programs in any way voluntary or giving people any choices in them at all is viewed as being a fatal concession to the programs themselves. But when you get into a system like a situation as the one we're entering right now, and a crisis draws nearer and nearer, ideas that were considered out of bounds at one time suddenly become on the table, because every other approach has been tried. People begin to fish around for other ones. So I would
say, I apologize for interrupting, but we want to make it clear you're not suggesting that they wouldn't pay into the system, only that if they opt out, they then are no longer subject to the death tax or
right.
gift tax.
Yeah, exactly. So if they keep working, they'd still be subject to payroll tax, but they would be exempt from all these other, and of course the estate tax just decimates people. I mean, which, and it has no moral justification. People have been taxed their whole lives. What is the justification for taxing them a second time on property that's already been taxed when they die? So,
well, Anthony Weiner says that you're not taxing those people a second time because they're dead, so you can't tax them a second time. You're taxing their descendant. I'm sorry, that was the famous Megyn Kelly fight that he had. So
I hadn't heard that. Okay, all right, you're taxing their descendants who are also already being taxed. So I can't, anyway, I can't even talk about these people. It just enrages me. Let's move on. I don't want to waste the time angry at this
guy. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I need my contempt tanks refilled once in a while.
But go ahead. You were spelling out.
Oh no, I'm all finished with that. But I mean, but in terms of other things, well, you know, in terms of cutting, I favor, you know, not the let's go through every line in the budget and see how much we can trim. That's just going to get all the special interests up in arms about why they should be exempted and our particular fiefdom shouldn't be touched and our budget is sacrosanct and the work we do is too important, is what every bureaucrat says. No, I would say instead we have to think in terms of across the board. So, you know, 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, whatever you think you can get away with across the board and say, look, it's an emergency. Everyone needs to cut. You figure out how to do it. The Department of Transportation 2 years ago had one guy earning over $160,000. Right now it has 1,700 people earning over $160,000. You're telling me they can't find room to trim that? So you cut across the board. Now, Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico, who's probably going to run for president. In fact, I'm pretty certain he's going to run for president. He's proposing a 43% across-the-board cut. He says, because that would actually be serious. Okay, well, he's not going to get elected, but we certainly need to hear that more than I need to hear another Rudy Giuliani telling me, making promises that he has no intention of keeping, and even if he did, they would make no dent in the problem whatsoever. Yeah, I do want to hear somebody who says something like that, because if we don't get jolted out of our apathy, we're going to get smacked in the head by this crisis, and frankly, we're going to deserve it.
Tell the listeners how they can get a hold of copies of your book. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any other places they can go to?
It's in all the stores, and it's on Amazon, but you can also read a free chapter, which if you don't buy the book, which, you know, I would be heartbroken, of course, but I really urge people to read the free chapter at rollbackbook.com, because at least there, what I'm trying to do is give people facts that are not disputed by anyone about our present situation. I mean, if Americans knew this stuff, we would be 100% better off. So at least I urge people to check that out at rollbackbook.com.
One of the things that we will do is put up copies of the book jackets of all of your recent books, and we'll connect that to Amazon.com, so if people want to buy your books, they can do so while they're listening to the show in the archive format online. Now, also, I want to congratulate you on something. I was literally looking for this because you're an economist. You did not use the word widget until page 84. And I know as an economist that must have been tough. Now, don't misunderstand that. As an economist, you were obligated to use it, but you waited until page 84.
Well, no, I mean, actually, just so people will know, I'm a historian by training. So these words have only, you know, by osmosis come into my head. I wasn't trained to use them. So that's why it took me all those pages to get to it.
I'm sorry. I had to get that shot in.
That's quite all right.
That's for every economics prof I had in college. I had to get that out there. I will be honest, I never lie to my listeners or my guests. I'm only about halfway through the book, but I am finding it very enjoyable. And it's so funny that you brought up the thing about winning arguments, because when I got about 50 pages in, I turned to my wife and I said, you know, I've got a feeling when I complete this book that I am never going to lose an argument about what caused the economic meltdown.
I'm glad.
Again. And I actually said that. I'm not saying that to flatter you. Those were my exact words to my wife. So
I appreciate that. That's just what I want to hear. Thank you.
It is 100% the truth, and I will tell all of my listeners, and I never do paid endorsements, but I can tell you that this is a book I recommend. It seems to have all the things in it that other books have been lacking in terms of just making this issue simple to understand. There's humor. humor in it. It's just an enjoyable read. So congratulations. I have a feeling that you've got another book that's going to hit that New York Times bestsellers list with Rollback.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I'm glad to have had the time today. Thank you.
That's all the time we have today. I want to invite everyone to join us next week when our guest will be Jack Cashel, the author of Deconstructing Obama, a book that sets out to prove that Bill Ayers wrote large chunks of Barack Obama's book, Dreams for My Father. Thanks again for listening. God bless you, and we'll let Scrappy sing us out.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.